Please excuse us. I guess there's been a change of plans. I guess we're just going to go ahead and welcome our special guest that we have here this evening, Dr. Michael Ledeen. Please help me welcome him.
Thank you. It reminds me, some years ago, Henry Kissinger was supposed to speak to a large audience, rather like this one, and the person introducing him said, well, if ever there were a person about whom it truly could be said that he needs no introduction, it's Dr. Kissinger. So without any further ado, I give you Dr. Kissinger. No. And Kissinger sat there and said to him, no. I want a proper introduction, and I'm not speaking until you get back up there and give me a proper introduction. So I was tempted with this to do the same thing, but I don't have the same standing. Thank you very much for having me. It's a treat. As many of you probably do not know, Los Angeles is my hometown. I was born here at Good Samaritan Hospital a very long time ago. My father worked for Walt Disney, so there is no more pure Southern Californian than I. I went to Pomona College, and while it's true that I left here nearly 40 years ago, the bulk of my family still lives here, and so it's always a pleasure to come back and spend time with my many relatives and to make new friends and acquaintances and to meet so many people with whom I've only spoken on the telephone, just imagined what you looked like. It's good to see your faces and so on. I want to start by trying to dispel a couple of illusions. Every Iranian that I meet immediately begins by thanking me for all the help that I and my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute have been giving the people of Iran. But you must understand that we are not doing it out of a feeling of generosity and or even affection for the people of Iran. We are doing it because it is what America must do, and we are doing it for America. We are doing it for our interests. And it's important for you to understand this, because later on I'm going to talk about what it is necessary to do in Iran to succeed and what most Iranians want to happen to their country. And it's terribly important that everybody act to fulfill their own responsibilities and to enhance the standing of their own country and their own people. And when I first started writing about Iran, the first article I wrote about Iran, about contemporary Iran, happened when an Iranian friend of mine in Europe said, you're supposed to be a journalist. Why is nobody writing about what is going on inside Iran? And I said, what's going on? He said, look at all the demonstrations. Look at millions of people in the streets. Look at the people turning out and demanding an end to the regime. It's an enormous event. And so I started looking and on internet and making phone calls and so forth, and I found this enormous story. And the first article I wrote was, a potentially earth-shaking event is underway in Iran, and no one has noticed. And it's amazing that no one has noticed, because nothing more wonderful could happen to the United States of America than the fall of the regime in Tehran. And I want to remind you of that. Because I didn't write an article and say, look at the poor Iranian people, how they suffer. Look at the poor Iranian people, what misery they have been reduced to. Look at this terrible regime which has bankrupted the society and stolen from the Iranian people and impoverished them all. And the single word that everybody uses that I know who goes to Iran and comes back from Iran is degradation. That this once great culture has been reduced to degradation, physical degradation of the infrastructure, of the streets, of the highways, of the roads, of the buildings, and so forth, and the moral degradation of the people, of little girls reduced to prostituting themselves on the streets because there's no other way that they can make ends meet, and people taking drugs and drinking themselves into a stupor because they cannot bear to face the degradation of everyday life. That was not my point, although it's all true and it's important. But that is not my point. My point was and is, because I'm an American, and I've never been to Iran, I must tell you, nor do I have relatives in Iran. I have now an amazing number of friends in Iran. My point is that the United States is involved in a war against terrorism. We were attacked on the 11th of September, 2001. Everything we are doing in the world right now stems from that event. We are not acting out of a sense of philanthropy. We did not invade Iraq because we felt that the poor Iraqi people desperately needed liberation, although we are happy to liberate them. We acted because there is a series of regimes which sponsor terrorism aimed against the Western world and primarily against the United States. And the one thing you must never forget is that it is the attack on America that is driving all of this. And we are responding to an attack against ourselves. And the president has said over and over and over again that the United States does not distinguish between the terrorists and the countries that support terrorism. And that is why Saddam Hussein is gone. And it is why the regime in Tehran will be gone. And the regime in Syria will be gone. So that said, that clarified, I want to talk to you a bit about democratic revolution and how democratic revolutions happen, because I think there's enormous misunderstandings about how revolution takes place and what is necessary for it to take place. I spent many years working in the government, first in the Department of State, then in the Department of Defense, and then finally at the National Security Council, all during the last years of the Soviet Empire. And there was a relative small handful of people in those years who believed that it was possible to bring down the Soviet Empire. Most people did not think it was possible. Most people took the survival of the Soviet Union and the Soviet satellites and the Soviet Empire as something that was going to last all our lifetimes and probably well beyond. Many of us did not think so because we looked at it and saw that it was actually a monumental failure. And that if you look carefully at the Soviet Empire, you could see that it had only failed. It had failed from the beginning to the end. In fact, all it had ever done was fail. And that the Western world had been forced to save it several times in its history. And that had the West been serious about destroying the Soviet Empire, it could have done it almost any time since the middle of the 1920s. And we saved Stalin, and we saved Brezhnev, and we saved Gorbachev, and we saved them with detente, and we saved them with loans, and we saved them with grain credits, and all the rest of it. And then finally, we got a president, Ronald Reagan, who said, no, this is an evil empire, and it's time to bring it to an end. And he brought it to an end. And it happened so easily and so surprisingly and so quietly that to this day, most people don't understand how that happened or why it happened, nor do they look at the 1980s and early 1990s in context and realize that we lived through what I called once the age of the second democratic revolution, because it wasn't just the Soviet Union that fell. Tyrannies fell all over the world. And it started in South America. Well, actually, it started in Spain, when an unexpectedly peaceful transition from dictatorship under Franco to democracy under a constitutional monarchy led by King Juan Carlos took place. And it took place when everybody in the world believed that you couldn't get from dictatorship to democracy without violence, without some kind of terrible violent act, whether it was a civil war of the sort that the Spaniards had fought in the 1930s or whether it was a violent insurrection in the streets. And part of that, especially here in America, comes from the movies, because the movies distort our understanding of history, because you can't get a gradual, peaceful revolution in a movie. You can only get it in a book. It doesn't film well. It's not dramatic enough. And so most people think of revolutions the way Hollywood has filmed them, storming the Winter Palace, charging the Bastille, something like that, or that scene in The Godfather about the fall of the tyranny in Cuba. And yet the Soviet Union just vanished. It just dried up and died. The air went out of its balloon. It didn't explode. It wasn't violently overthrown. It imploded. It collapsed. And now if you look all over the world in those years, tyrannies collapsed and vanished peacefully from the world in country after country. When Ronald Reagan came to power, when he was elected president of the United States, there were only, I'm bad at numbers, but it's roughly this, there were only two elected governments in all of South America. When he left office, there were only two unelected governments in all of the area from the Rio Grande River to the South Pole, and those were Cuba and Suriname. Every other country in Central and South America had by then elected governments. And there were no great wars, and there were no massive acts of violence, no winter palaces were stormed, no Bastilles were overthrown, no kings were decapitated, no prime ministers were hung from lampposts. It just happened. And then there was a pause, and now it's starting up again, the same process. And it's a bit more dramatic nowadays, but we've seen in recent years, for example, the fall of Milosevic in Yugoslavia. And while that was a bit more colorful and a bit more Hollywoody, if you like, there too, the people of the country simply turned out and said to their tyrant, "It's over. Be gone. Get out of here." And that government fell without violent civil war, without dramatic events. I mean, yes, there were some rallies, there were some strikes, there were protests, and all of that. But democratic revolution in this day and age can be accomplished and has been accomplished for the most part without terrible acts of violence, without enormous loss of blood, and all of that. The key event in the fall of dictatorship is something that you can't see, you can't measure, you can't quantify it, you can't see it on television, you can only smell it. And that is a loss of will, a failure of will on the part of the dictator. And you never know when that is going to happen. But I mean, in the case of the Soviet Union, it obviously happened when Gorbachev came to power. It was my favorite example. I mean, up until Gorbachev, every Soviet dictator believed himself to be the fulfillment of history's will. And as a person chosen by the dialectic to lead the Soviet Union to world domination. And one day, Mikhail Gorbachev looked in the mirror and saw not that, but a person trying very hard to keep his job. And that was the end. And then the Soviet people looked at him and they said, "It's over." And they started running out of Austria and protesting in Poland and carrying out a quiet revolution in Czechoslovakia, and bit by bit the whole thing just fell apart and it disintegrated and it died. My guess is that is what is now going on inside Iran, because what I have written all these many months and what everybody in the world knows, and the leaders of the regime tell you that. All you have to do is listen to them. I mean, they are the most reliable guides to what is going on inside Iran. What's going on is that these people are now terrified, because they have expected all along, everybody knew it was going to happen, we were going to arrive in Iraq, and Saddam was going to fall, and we were then going to free that country and give it democracy so that people could make their own decisions and determine their own lives. And I have to tell you, there's a great thing happened the other day, which a friend of mine pointed out. I had missed it entirely because she watches television and I don't. And she said, there was a great thing on television from Iraq. First they showed the British in Basra. And the British had taken over Basra and they'd installed some old sheikh that they had hanging around for 50 years and put him in charge of Basra. And then they laid down a whole series of rules. And they said, okay, nobody can have weapons. Everybody has to be at home at this time and can't come out until that time. This is the person in charge of running this and that and the other thing. They just laid out a whole set of rules for the people. Then they showed the Marines in Baghdad. And I have to tell you that we're very partial to Marines in our family because our number one son is halfway to becoming a Marine officer. And so we get a lot of emails from Marines in Iraq. So we followed this war very closely. Anyway, so they were talking to a Marine who was walking through the streets of Baghdad. And people came up to him to talk to him. And they said, look, you know, what about guns? And the Marines in Baghdad decided that they didn't want big accumulations of weapons. So they said, nobody gets to have more than one gun. So if you want to have a gun and keep it at home, that's fine. That's what we do. We have guns at home in America. You can have a gun at home, but you can't have a lot of guns. One gun per person, that's enough. And they said, okay, one gun per person. And then they said, you know, we've turned in a lot of these terrible Ba'athists and so forth to you, and a lot of them have been arrested, but we see a lot of them back out on the streets. And they said to this particular Marine, so we're taking care of them ourselves. And the Marine said, that's fine. You take care of them yourselves. It's your country. You don't like them. You take care of them. You have to start doing that. And then another person came up and said, you know, there's been crime in our streets, so we're organizing groups in our streets to take care of it and so on. And the Marine said, that's what you should do. In other words, what's going on is that the Marines in Iraq, block by block and person by person and issue by issue, are saying to the Iraqis, this is your country. You assume responsibility for it. You are going to have to govern it yourselves. We believe that you are capable of making your own decisions and determining your own destiny. We are not going to stay here and rule you and tell you what to do. You're going to have to grow up and join the rest of the world and assume responsibility for your own country. We're going to be out of here as fast as we can get out of here. And we will. I mean, Marines don't want to live in Iraq. And General Garner does not wish to live in Baghdad long either. He wants to install a civil government, get things in an orderly fashion, and then the future of that country will be up to them. And you know better than I, there's long been in the Western world, and even in the United States, which is supposed to be immune to this kind of thinking, there's been a kind of racism directed toward Muslims in general, and Arabs in particular. There's a kind of belief out there that there is something somehow built into Islam that makes it impossible for people to govern themselves, and that Arabs, in any case, can never govern themselves. Because there's something in their DNA. There's some missing democratic chromosome, right? That makes them that they can't do it. And yet, if you look at the history of that part of the world, I mean, for a very long time, for most of modern history, Islam was the high point of the world, the highest level of culture, the highest level of civilization, the most tolerant of societies. I'm Jewish. Jewish people throughout the Middle Ages, if they had the chance, if they were able to choose between living in Catholic Europe or the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim world, they were much better off in the Muslim world. Much better off, incomparably better off. And all of that talk about, Renaissance and Reformation, there never could have been a Renaissance without Muslim civilization, because all of the truth, all of the real documents of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, which was the basis for the European Renaissance, they were all preserved in Alexandria and Baghdad because they were all destroyed in Catholic Europe. So Americans who know that people from everywhere are capable of self-government, because we've proved it, because this country is composed of people from everywhere. And we govern ourselves. So there's nothing genetic that prevents any given kind of person or any person with any set of religious beliefs from governing himself. It can be done. It's just a question of whether people are prepared to do it. So what we have said to the Iraqis, and what I say to you, and what we will say to you, is that Iranians are going to have to assume responsibility for their own destiny. And they cannot and must not look constantly outside Iran to other places and other peoples and say, we've made a terrible mess. Iran is in a terrible circumstance. Come and save us. That's not the way it's supposed to be. People are supposed to save themselves at a certain point. Countries make mistakes. Whole civilizations make mistakes. Sometimes they even make fatal mistakes. Civilizations have committed suicide. Whole nations are quite capable of committing suicide. It has happened. Most everything has happened in history at one time or another. But Iran has not. Iran has actually gone through a kind of vaccination process against tyranny. Because the Iranians convinced themselves in 1979 that they were staging a glorious revolution against tyranny. And then they discovered a few years later that they had made a terrible mistake. And that in thinking they were acting against tyranny, they had installed a tyranny even worse than the one they thought they were fighting against. And now, a generation later, everything we know about Iran, everything we know about the whole country, everybody in it, without exception, is that everyone agrees that the Islamic Republic is a failure. There's not one person in Iran, I mean, this is for sure, there's not one person in Iran who believes the Iranian Republic is a success. At the latest meeting of the National Security Council, the Interior Minister, the Information Minister, presented to Khamenei and the others a list of 1,600 failed problems in Iran and said, if we do not deal with these problems, the whole country is going to blow up. Now, I'm an historian. I mean, I've studied a lot of history. I don't know of another country in history where an interior minister or an information minister came to the king or to the tyrant or to the president and said, sir, we have failed in 1,600 ways. And if we don't deal with these things, we're finished. Now, those are the rulers of Iran. The people of Iran know it in detail because they are suffering the consequences of the 1,600, right? This is a government where when they take their own public opinion polls, they come up with 71% of the population that hates them. And these polls, I mean, just think concretely, how are these polls conducted? You are a normal citizen of a major city in Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, you're walking down the street, some person comes up to you with a clipboard and says, hello, I'm from your Ministry of Information, and I would like to ask you a few questions about how you feel about our regime. And so you know this is a loyalty check. Even though the people knew perfectly well that it was a loyalty check, 71% of them said, this government stinks. We don't like it. We'd like to see it changed. And when a CIA polling organization called from Washington, so imagine you're sitting at home in Tehran and the phone rings and you say hello, and a voice says in a kind of funny accented Farsi, hello, I'm calling from a public opinion firm in Washington, D.C., and I would like to ask you a few questions about how you feel about your government. So there it is again. So you don't know if this call is really coming from Washington, D.C., but you know, whatever it is, it's another loyalty check. And there they got 74, 75% that didn't like it. So if you get these numbers in these circumstances, you know that the real numbers are much higher. All right? So what's the conclusion? What is the bottom line, as we say? There's 70 million people in Iran. So let's take the conservative figure. Let's say it's about 70%. People don't like it. So 50 million out of the 70 million people in Iran don't like the regime. Let's say on a bad day, you could get 10% of them to turn out in a demonstration against the regime. That's 5 million people. And that's 10% of 70%. And these are all conservative figures, because probably it's more like 80 or 85%, and probably it's more like 55 or 60 million. And probably you could get 25 or 30% of them to turn out on a given day, right? Now, is there anyone in this room that does not believe that if you put two million people in Tehran, a million people in Isfahan, a half a million people in Shiraz, and put them in the central squares of those towns and told them all to stop working and shut down the oil fields and shut down the textile industry and close the schools and block the roads and had those people say to the regime, okay, it's over. All we want, we don't want your neck, we don't want your blood, we just want you gone, that it wouldn't work? All right. So if that's true, as I believe it's true, and it doesn't require the United States Marines marching in across the border, and they're not going to march, believe me. There is not a person in Washington who has the slightest intention of ever giving an order to drop a single bomb on Iran or fire a single bullet into Iran. Nobody. Not the wildest hawk, not the most bloodthirsty neoconservative, as we are all called nowadays. No one, right? We will support the Iranian people. We will broadcast to the Iranian people. We will do all of that.